Welcome to the Strange and Unusual Book Club, where we read horror, fantasy, and science fiction books and share our thoughts with you. I'm Haley.
And I'm Kayla. This episode, we're talking about The Long Walk, written by Stephen King as Richard Bachman, published in 1979 by Signet Books.
So we've read quite a few Stephen King books. I think Stephen King is probably the greatest living writer that we have right now. So naturally, we gotta cover The Long Walk because it just got a film adaptation and it's Stephen King's birthday.
And it was the first book he wrote. So what better way to start our podcast with the master himself?
And though this is the first episode of our podcast, it is not our first Strange and Unusual Book Club. We've been doing this. This is our third year. We started with a live stream and we've been doing that every month for the last 3 years.
Yeah, 2.5, 3 years. We actually started with Cabin at the End of the World by Paul Tremblay, which we started because it was also adapted into a movie.
We originally started as just a horror thing, but then we've expanded so that I can read something that's not just horror. Horror tends to be primarily what I read, but Kayla is our science fiction and fantasy expert, and she has since introduced me to the world of dragons and hobbits, and I'm having a good time with it.
It's a really fun place to be.
So you mentioned that The Long Walk was Stephen King's first book.
Yeah. So Carrie is the first book that was published by Stephen King, but he wrote The Long Walk in 1966.
That's when he was a freshman in college, right?
Yeah, he was 19 years old. It was the height of the Vietnam War, and young Stephen King wrote this book. And I think knowing his age at the time and what was going on really makes a difference in how the book is perceived.
So we'll get into the plot a little bit here before we kind of like delve deeper into the meat of the glorious Stephen King sandwich that we're about to bite into. So this is a dystopian novel, kind of like one of the original Death Game type novels. You think about things like The Hunger Games and Battle Royale. It's definitely along those lines. It's also very similar to another book he's written, The Running Man. And in this one, everyone who signs up for The Long Walk is a volunteer. They live in a time that is very desolate, I want to say.
It feels very Great Depression era, but without like the Vanderbilts or whoever is the equivalent of that time.
And they have this long walk, which they tell people, and it feels very propaganda-ish. They tell people it's to inspire you to believe that things can get better, because whomever wins the long walk gets a wish, which is anything they want. So a lot of these boys sign up for the long walk, and they're hoping to maybe change their lives.
Yeah. But the catch is, everybody except for one dies. It's a last man standing competition. So 100 boys enter and you walk until there's one left.
Yeah, there is no finish line to the long walk. No. And it will go on as long as it needs to until there is only one boy left. And like you just mentioned, it's only boys. And they have to be under the age of 18. So between 16 and 18. So these are very young boys. Mm-hmm. And that made me think of like The Hunger Games and Battle Royale, where it's going after the nation's children. And even though they're doing this propaganda thing saying like, oh, it's to make us believe again, I feel like they're killing our kids because they're televising this. They're killing our kids to basically say, you do not want to speak out against the government.
Yeah. I mean, there's squads that whisk people off in the middle of the night for speaking out against the government and the walk itself. If you say anything bad about the walk, you're done for.
A few things about the long walk. They have to walk at least 4 miles per hour.
That's really fast.
That's a brisk walk.
Yeah, you have to keep up.
You are not having casual conversation. You are not lollygagging.
No, there's no dilly-dallying. If you stop for more than, is it 10 seconds? It feels like, but I think it might be like 30 seconds. You get a warning. After 3 warnings, you get your ticket, which means you get shot.
And what's really cool about the way this book is written is you hear early on, hey, there was a kid who froze up on the starting line and he got his ticket. And you're like, okay, you know, he got a ticket. Probably got sent home. Mm-hmm. They're voted off the island like Survivor. And you don't realize until we're into the long walk and the first boy goes down that getting a ticket means getting shot in the head.
Yeah. It's kept pretty vague until it actually happens. And you think, you know, this is a book about walking. How exciting can it be? Well, it's probably one of the heaviest things that you'll ever experience in your life. Okay, let's dive into the characters. Our main character that we have is Ray Garrity. He's number 47. He is 16. He's the local boy. He's from Maine, where this book takes place, as most Stephen King books do. But he's the local boy, so he's the local hero.
And it's told from his point of view, so we kind of get the sense that he is the main character. And on top of that, he is the favorite because it is in Maine, so there are people who will gather on the sidelines, crowds that gather, and a lot of them are rooting for Garrity because he is the main guy.
Yeah,
he's the main guy. Oh my gosh.
The main guy and the main guy, the main guy. He is not the hero that this world feels like it deserves, but I think he makes sense for the story.
I agree, he makes sense. And that's something Stephen King does that I do really like, and something you're not going to find in a lot of like your YA dystopian novels, where there are characters you can really get behind and root for, and you kind of want to be them because they're heroic. Ray Garrity is not a hero. He is a confused, horny young man. And yeah, he didn't join for any heroic means. He actually doesn't know why he joined. It's just what you do.
It's just what you do. And I think it's kind of about like realizing your potential and what you can do. But the Ray Garrity that we're meeting starts out as cocky and so sure of himself, and he can't be the one who dies. He's giving main character energy, as the youth would say. But he's not an athlete. He likes to knit and read and dance. He's not a super physical guy, but he ends up being the glue that holds this ragtag group of boys together.
So other main characters, Ray forms a bit of a friend group pretty early on. I think the character he grows closest to is Peter McVries.
He's number 61. He's from New Jersey. He's described as awesomely fit. He has a scar across his cheek, which we find out later how he gets it, but it's a long time coming, that story.
He's really nice to Garrity. He's kind of mean to a lot of the other guys, particularly this guy, Olson. He doesn't like Olson. Olson comes in very, very confident. He's all like, Hank's the name, Watkins the game. And McVries just finds that so fucking annoying.
He's just raring to rip. He's ready to go. And yeah, McVries is irritated by him for sure. We also have the character Stebbins. He's kind of a loner. He's described as a lean Buddha. He's very, like, stoic and speaks mysteriously.
He's very cryptic. And right away, Garrity hates this guy for no freaking reason. He just sees him eating jam sandwiches and he's like, I hate him. Which I love that they eat jam sandwiches. I thought that was always like a British thing. But no.
So jam sandwich, no peanut butter.
Yeah, like you just have jam sandwiches.
Like a scone?
I mean, just bread with some jam in it, dude.
I love it. I'm here for it. Like toast. Like toast with jam.
It's like two bread. Pieces of bread.
I love it. I'm going to have to try this one of these days. We also have Art Baker. He's also very close with Garrity and McVries.
He's the Southern boy. He's a little more religious.
Yeah, he's from Louisiana. They describe him as young and beautiful and almost ethereal.
And then, of course, there's the Major, who the Major, he's only really in the beginning and the end, but he is kind of the face of the Long Walk. He is the person who you see, you know, on the recruitment posters and stuff at the Long Walk. And he's the one telling the boys to sack it up. And it's a man's journey here.
We really don't get that much of him. We learn a lot about him, but it's really through the boys.
But he's like this overwhelming force. Kind of makes me think of like Uncle Sam or somebody who's like not even really a person, but an idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's a good way of describing him.
I think we've gotten to about as far as we can possibly go and keeping you guys safe from spoilers. So we're going to get into spoiler territory. We're going to spoil absolutely everything about this book so that we can really get into just the nitty gritty of the themes and the characters and explore it. So if you don't want spoilers, I'm just going to tell you now, you should read the book. It's a good book.
Yeah, read the book and then come back and hang out with us. Or if you're like, I'm never going to read this book, so I don't care about spoilers and you just want to hear what we have to say about it, that's okay too.
So I wanted to talk about Stebbins. I think he has one of the more interesting motivations. We find out pretty late in the book that he is an illegitimate son of the Major. And his motivation for joining the walk is he wants to be invited into the Major's house for tea. He wants to be treated like an actual son, to be acknowledged, to be welcomed in his home.
Yeah, he describes himself as the rabbit. the rabbit from like Greyhound races that's like everybody is trying to catch up with but will never catch. And I almost feel like he's kind of describing himself that way in like relation to his dad too. Like he's never really going to catch and attain what he wants, but he has to try. He has to keep going.
So the rabbit conversation he has is towards the end, and it's something that he realizes when he realizes he's going to die. He tells them that he is the major's son and that the major is aware of that. But he realizes that there was never going to be a future where he was invited into his father's house. That his father wants him there. He's happy he's there. But because he is going to set the pace for the other boys. He's in good shape. He's got motivation. He's going to make it till towards the end. But his father never had any faith that he would win. The rabbit is not supposed to win the race. They're just supposed to set the pace. What I also find very interesting about this is you look at how Stebbins dies. He ends up being one of the last two boys in the race. He is just ahead of Garrity, but Garrity catches up to him and then Stebbins grabs him by the collar and he's like, Garrity! And then he has a heart attack. It's interesting because the rabbit is the pacemaker, right? Which is also another word for something that we use to mechanize our hearts to keep them going. But just like the rabbit and just like a pacemaker, he just kind of falls apart like broken machinery.
Yeah.
It's like he got to the end of where he was going, the Energizer Bunny, and then he just falls over.
And then he just gives out.
Yeah. And really, in the story, he has that same point. Because the whole book, Garrity hates Stebbins. Mm. And even if he doesn't win, he just wants to beat Stebbins. He says that repeatedly. He just wants to beat Stebbins. He hates him for no apparent reason. Like how I hate Adam Scott. Has Adam Scott ever done anything to me? No. He seems like a perfectly nice guy. But he has a horribly punchable face.
That's so unfair. He is an American treasure.
And I'm aware of this, but that's how Garrity is for Stebbins. It's true. He has no good reason for disliking this boy. He seems like a perfectly nice boy. But he is the rabbit in that he pushes Garrity to make it to the end. Maybe Garrity wouldn't have gotten as far as he did if he didn't hate Stebbins for no good reason so much.
Yeah. And what does that mean? Like, what is Stephen King trying to tell us there? That your hate can fuel you to the ends of the earth?
I think so, but I think it also was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy because as soon as he served his purpose of setting that pace, of getting Garrity to the end, he dies. That was his purpose.
Yeah, and he fulfilled it.
Yeah, it's like when you realize you're not the main character because Garrity's the main character.
He is. He absolutely is. And he says it and he feels it. There's a quote that says, there was still the unshakable blind assurances that the organism Ray Garrity could not die. The others could die. They were extras in the movie of his life, but not Ray Garrity, star of that long-running hit film, The Ray Garrity Story. Maybe he would even eventually come to understand the untruth of that emotionally as well as intellectually. Maybe that was the final depth of which Stebbins had spoken. It was a shivery, unwelcome thought.
So I want to come back to Garrity in a little bit because there's another character I think really ties into Garrity and some of my feelings about Garrity that I think I want to explore. But McVries is a very interesting character. Initially, you would think because he's the character who puts himself in danger so much for Garrity, as in when Garrity's about ready to give up, he's like, come on, you can keep going. He motivates him for no reason. Why would he want this guy to survive?
Yeah, he doesn't know him.
He should want himself to survive. He should be like, okay, good. The odds are now better for me. But he doesn't. And he's not a very nice person. He is very antagonistic towards Olsen because Olsen rubbed him the wrong way. So he's constantly like hard on him. And they even tell him like, hey, just leave him alone.
He's definitely a button pusher.
Absolutely. He loves to see people's buttons and to push them. And then we find out that he has a very dark backstory. So I'm going to give a trigger warning for SA here because we're going to get into some dark stuff that you might not be ready for.
So McVries, towards the end, Ray asks him how he got his scar.
He had a girlfriend who was named Priscilla, and he describes her as the love of his life. Like, he was head over heels about this girl, and they were going to move away and maybe get married and all this stuff. Well, they go to the city, and they get a job at a pajama factory. And Priscilla does very well at this pajama factory. Her job is to sew on buttons, and she's very successful, and she gets promoted, and she makes all these new friends. She's making a lot more money than him. He's not doing well at this job. And he's very jealous because we get into one of the themes of this novel, which is kind of a gender norms and expectations. He's the man. Therefore, he should make more money. And instead of being happy for her, he begins to resent her. Eventually, he decides he wants to move home. Priscilla says she does not want to go back. She wants to break up. She's going to stay there. And in not so many words, he says that he tried to encourage her to go to bed with him, and then she got a letter opener and cut his face. But then he goes on to say that she was like, why were you trying to hurt me? So we know it's a lot more violent and forceful and certainly non-consensual than how McFreeze is telling it. But I think Stephen King did a good job there of telling us the story, but giving us enough information that we were able to read between the lines.
Yeah, we were spared the details, but we know full well what occurred.
Exactly. Which is obviously awful. And even though he says some pretty awful things about this girl, mm-hmm. he does not speak about her in kind terms at all. I think the way that he's constantly looking out for Garrity is his way of maybe trying to find some atonement. Like, he wants to believe he's a good person.
Yeah, I think he wants to be a good person. He wants to prove to himself that he can be the man he was capable of being, even though there's not much time left.
Yeah, I think initially when he joined, he just had a death wish. And he's like, well, I have nothing to lose, so might as well. Mm-hmm. I honestly think he never wanted to win. Mm-hmm. He just wanted to die. And this was easier than suicide. Mm-hmm. But when he sees how he is earning respect from the group, I think he realizes, I don't have to just die. I could die and do something good. Maybe there's a chance for me to have some kind of atonement in mm-hmm. this. So it's not laid out directly, but that was the impression I got.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think one of the themes is that redemption, but also the power of positive relationships. And would he be the man he was if he'd had more people, more friends like Ray Garrity in his life? He was poor. He had nothing going for him, which is why he left with Priscilla to go work at this pajama factory. So maybe if he'd had more of a strong family, more friends that he could really depend on, maybe he wouldn't have behaved the way he did or made the decisions that he did. Who knows?
I think it also goes to show that people are complicated. In real life, we don't just have straight up villains and heroes. It's not like a lot of those YA novels where we have the great hero who has adorable flaws because they're clumsy or whatever. But these people have real flaws. They have real ugly things that they've done. And for me, I will say, once I found out about McFreeze's past, I was like, yeah, I don't care. You're not redeeming yourself for me. Mm-hmm. But I do like that the characters were complicated and they challenged our ideas of it. Because up until that point, I was like, okay, this is a person who's putting himself on the line. Mm-hmm. He's somebody I like. And then you find out that and it's like, well, now I don't like him. Or even with Garrity, he's posited as the main character, but he has so many disturbing thoughts about women, mm-hmm. about the other boys on the walk, that you're left to wonder, is anyone capable of being a hero on the long walk?
Yeah. Is there any good, really, in anybody?
So I want to talk about Barkovich.
Okay.
From the offset, he does not get along with the other boys. And he tells them later on, like, I'm always getting off on the wrong foot with people. And he explains that he carries a razor blade because he's bullied so badly at his school that he has to be able to defend himself. And what turns them against Barkovich is pretty early on the walk. There is a smaller boy named Rank. And we do not know what the exchange is between Barkovich and Rank. We know that there is shouting, mm-hmm. but Rank could have started it. We're from Garrity's point of view here. We do not know who started it. We do not know what was said. However, Rank starts pushing Barkovich. So the boys naturally assume, because Barkovich is mouthy, that he was running his mouth and that pushed Rank to violence. And then, you know, once it's already going, Barkovich is inciting him, you know, to violence. Yes. Now he's like, oh, come out and get me. But he never once tries to hit him back. Mm-hmm. And then finally, Rank ends up falling over in trying to get Barkovich, and then he trips himself and he gets his ticket. What gets me about it is the boys, Olsen, Garrity, I think Art, they all refer to Barkovich as a murderer and they taunt him with this and they really make him kind of isolated and kicked out of the group.
But we don't know what started it. And this is the 14th death. So it's pretty early on, but the tensions are starting to build enough that they are really emotionally heightened. So in that state, it's kind of easy to see how they could turn on him so quickly. It's easy to create a villain.
I think they needed a villain.
They did.
Because absolutely. At that point, they're too afraid to call the Major a villain. They're too afraid to speak out against the Walk.
Yeah.
They need a safe villain mm-hmm. that they can hate. And it's safe to hate Barkovich.
Yeah.
There's no repercussions for that.
No.
And it bonds them together.
Yeah. I don't agree with it, obviously, but, you know, reading this from the comfort of my couch instead of on the road, walking for miles and my feet hurting with already having seen 13 boys being shot, it makes sense why they picked him as the villain.
Barkovich leads to why I dislike Garrity so much, because I think he is such a hypocrite. Garrity asked Barkovich what he would wish for. Mm-hmm. So at this point, Barkovich has gone up to Garrity and he's just like a guy needs friends. Like, I'm going to die. And I never meant for that kid to die. I never wanted that to happen. And now everybody hates me. And I think I just got off on the wrong foot with you guys. And I'm really not that bad of a guy. He's basically begging Garrity to be his friend. Mm. And he's like, will you tell the other guys that I didn't mean it, that I didn't mean for that boy to get hurt. He, you know, I just want some friends. He knows he's going to die with these boys and he doesn't want to die hated. And even says that's about the worst thing that could happen is that you could die hated. So Garrity asks, what would you wish for if you won? And I love his answer. Again, why I love Barkovich. He says he'd wish for plastic feet. Points for Barkovich. But then Garrity says, I thought maybe you'd wish for friends. Garrity said sadly, a heady sense of triumph, suffocating, enthralling roar through him. Friends? Because you don't have any. Garrity said pityingly, we're all glad to see you die. No one's going to miss you. Maybe I'll walk behind you and spit on your brains after they blow them all over the road. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe we all will. The immediate turnaround of this is that it breaks Barkovich. And he tears out his own throat with his hands. I am not entirely sure that's even possible.
But he does it.
He must have some freaking claws on him. But I guess if you're in such distress or you're really just that amped up, you can. You'd have to be pretty upset to do that, to rip out your own throat.
Yeah. I guess because I don't have the hatred you have for Garrity, but I don't really see Garrity as a person as much as a vessel for putting us on this road of, God, what's the word? Just like hopelessness and seeing the worst in people, bringing out all these really, really horrible things in a person. So as a character, absolutely, Garrity is despicable. McFreeze, they're all pretty despicable in one way or another. But when I was reading it, I wasn't relating to Garrity as a person so much as...
like an audience replacement character.
Yeah, I could feel what he was feeling when he's trying to sleep a little bit, when he's like hearing the things going on around him, the emotions that he's going through versus the actions he takes.
He's the character that is cementing you into this horrible world.
Yes. It's dark, it's sad, it's hopeless, it's physically painful, it's ugh.
So I want to talk about the ending.
Okay.
We see the Major roll up in his tank and Garrity doesn't even acknowledge him. He sees a dark figure in the distance. And then what's interesting is it says that he decides to run. And that's the end of the book. It's very abrupt.
Yeah, that's it. It just is. And somehow he found the strength to run or something to that effect. And so we don't know what happens. We don't know if he dies right then and there, if he lasts maybe a week before he totally cracks and dies, like people in the past have done after they've won the long walk, if somehow he recovers and he goes back to his mom and finds a way to live the rest of his life. We have no idea.
And what's interesting is we have never heard about any long walkers who've won getting their reward. Mm-hmm. The only two survivors they've talked about is one, a guy that Stebbins saw win, and the moment his companion that he was walking with falls down, he's like begging that guy to wake up, to not leave him. So he seems so distraught that he probably didn't even ask for anything. Oh, and then there was another one where they say that the guy had an aneurysm mm-hmm. like a week later.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like anybody ever wins the long walk. It reminds me a lot of like the end of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, Yeah, she got away, but she's laughing like a maniac. She is not okay.
Like, is that even living? Yeah, no, and the long walk is, it's so demanding mentally, the game that it is. There's no way anybody could be okay on the other side of this.
I do want to know what your interpretation of the dark figure and the ending is, because I've read a lot of different ones online. Danny and I have very different interpretations of the ending. Would love to know what yours is.
I don't know that I have one. I just assumed he lost his mind. I don't know that there really was any dark figure up there. Like, maybe he didn't want to believe that he was the last one, that all of his friends truly had died, and that there was still somebody left out there. But I don't think I really...
So, like, he's lost his mind and the race will never be over. He'll just keep walking.
Yeah.
My interpretation of it was that he perceives the dark figure as death.
Okay.
And I think at this point he has lost everybody that he cared about on the long walk. And the long walk has become so much his life that he can't really remember anything outside of it. He's no longer thinking about Jan or his mom. And then when he sees death, I think all he really wants is to rejoin the friends he made. He's running towards death because now he, like McVries, has a death wish. He just wants to be dead. And I don't think he ever wants to sit down until he can sit down with his friends.
I think that that makes sense. What was Dan's thought on it?
So Dan, he believes that Stebbins won. Oh. He thinks that Garrity has lost his mind and that we cannot trust him as a narrator at the end of the story. He thinks it doesn't make sense that Stebbins just like croaked, like just fell over all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And he thinks that at that point we can no longer trust Garrity, so that he falls down and he dies. And then when he sees the dark figure, that it is death and he's crossed over.
Okay.
So he's walking into the afterlife. It's just kind of like life. You just keep walking.
That's really depressing.
I know. So I've read some other interpretations too. Some people who are big King fans, constant readers, interpret the dark figure as Randall Flagg. Now, I have seen Stephen King make a lot of mentions that a lot of the inspiration for Flagg did come from this, because he calls him the Walken Man in The Stand. Randall Flagg is a demonic character who has been around as long as Pennywise, as long as some of his worst characters. And he's a guy who wears a denim jacket and he just walks along the road. He was in Eyes of the Dragon. Uh-huh. He's also in the Gunslinger, Dark Tower books.
Okay.
He's one of the bigger Stephen King villains and certainly one of the ones that returns the most.
Yeah. I like that idea. I haven't read The Stand, but we did read The Eyes of the Dragon. And God, he's terrifying. He's a terrifying character.
So let's get into like our themes and analysis of The Long Walk. So I think one of the ones we've already mentioned a little bit is the Vietnam War.
Yeah, so he was 19 when he wrote this book in 1967. So this was like the middle of the Vietnam War that this book was written. So it was a huge part of Stephen King's life. And I bet he saw many of his friends go off and never come back, or go off and come back completely changed and not the boys he knew.
I feel like a lot of the horrors of war came to light with Vietnam because they were showing so much of it on TV that we saw a lot of the ugliness of war. And so it's a lot like The Long Walk. You would have little kids sitting down for dinner and they're seeing horribly maimed people on television, on the news.
I'm not going to claim to know enough about the Vietnam War to talk about it in any kind of detail, but the outcomes, the way that people came out of that war, it was just really, really horrific.
Another similarity is just the age of the boys. You know, to be drafted for the military, you are about 18, you're a young man. I still think it's so strange in this country that, you know, we've had drafts for boys who are 18 years old, who are not old enough to order a drink. I think if you can die for your country, you deserve to have a beer.
Amen. I agree with that completely. When you're 18, you definitely feel like an adult. But at this point in our lives, we're past 18. And looking at 18-year-olds, I'm like, those are literal babies.
They're babies. And that's the thing. Like, you know when you play the game of life, the board game?
Yeah.
You can go the college route, and it takes you a little bit longer. You can go straight to work. I feel like joining the military or joining the long walk, it's like taking that straight to work one where you get a skip and now you're instantly a man. And you're not, I don't think, fully prepared for what you're going into. They treat it almost like sports, like football, which is another thing that's really pushed us being very masculine. And the full weight of you may not come home isn't really hitting them. They're focused on the adventure of it. They're not thinking about the very scary gravity of what they've committed to.
That 99 of them will die.
Yes. Also, and I think there's actually some truth to them becoming men. I don't think it happens at recruitment. I don't think it happens when you sign the papers for the long walk. But these boys start in the beginning and they have all this energy and excitement, but it does break them down. And just like in war, they form this band of brothers. And these people become more important to them than anybody waiting for them at home because they've experienced something with them that nobody else on this earth will understand. But they're also forced to see those same friends die horribly. And there's no honor or glory in the way that these people die. One boy dies having diarrhea, you know, with his pants down. There's no honor in that, even though the major will say, like, oh, you know, they did this great thing. The boy died covered in shit with his pants down.
Yes.
And unfortunately, a lot of people in war don't die with any honor or dignity either.
They say specifically that they're dying for trivialities. It's all trivial. None of what they're doing really means anything, but they're dying anyway.
They're promised this reward in the long walk, but the book does not give us any examples of anybody asking for a wish and then enjoying it. It seems like most of the people that they know of who've won are just broken. And so it's an empty promise. And even if you did survive, seeing 99 people your age in your peer group shot, it's going to do a number on you.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's any reward you could truly enjoy after seeing that.
Yeah. There is a line in the book, potato soup or sirloin tips, a mansion or a hovel. Once you're dead, that's it. They put you on a cooling board like Zucker Ewing, and that's it. Like, it doesn't matter. The prize in the end doesn't really matter. Or, I guess, not that the money doesn't matter, but, like,
the prize doesn't make anything that they suffered worth it.
Exactly. Exactly. They're 99 of them are dead.
Kind of like, again, random movie thing here, but Indecent Proposal, where he lets a man spend the night with his wife for, like, $1 million. And in the end, he doesn't even want $1 million. He buys a freaking hippo with it, I think. Because nothing will take away the pain that it caused him. There's no reward that can make the pain of seeing all your friends shot. Okay, you might as well just buy a hippo.
Just buy a hippo.
So another theme in here to get less political. Personally, for what I saw the long walk as a metaphor for life. Mm-hmm. In particular, growing up. Because I think when we're kids, like, everyone's so excited to grow up. You're so excited for that next birthday. And yet when we become adults, we all look back.
You know, when you're younger, you have worries, you have concerns, and you think that those are the worst things that you could ever be worried about. But then as you get older, you have way more difficult things to worry about and be concerned about and to bring you down. And you long for the things you thought were upsetting to you. Because it's like, oh, I can deal with my best friend being mad at me. I cannot deal with my best friend being shot in front of me.
Yeah. So it made me think a lot about like how when you're kids, you're always like, I'm 12 and a half or I'm 8 and a half. You're so excited to grow up. But then if you actually asked a child, well, why are you excited to grow up? I don't think they would know. Just like these boys don't know why they signed up for the walk. Mm-mm. Are you excited to pay taxes? Are you excited to be in a loveless marriage? Are you excited to work in a dead-end job? Are you excited to have back pain every single day? There's a lot of things about growing up that are not fun.
Right.
And the things that are fun, I don't know if children would value. Like, are you excited to watch your grandchildren play in the yard? I don't think any of these things are exciting to children. It's just this idea. And so when they ask the boys, why did you join? They're like, I don't know. I think it's a lot like, why are you excited to grow up? I don't know. I just am. So, like, that's the beginning of the walk, and they have all of this energy.
Yeah, they're young. They can walk for miles and miles and never get tired.
With age comes wisdom, but you're also just so goddamn tired. I have a lot more wisdom than I did as a kid, but I do not have that energy. And we see that with the walkers, is in the beginning, they have all of this energy, and they say they probably could have overthrown them in the beginning when they had the energy, but they didn't have the knowledge then.
That was a conversation that Doug and I had after the movie. He was like, why didn't they just take them over? I said, they talk about it like at the beginning, that's not what they're upset about. They're not upset. They don't think they need to take them over. They just need to win. right? They're invincible. They're going to win and all of their problems will be solved. But as the gravity of the situation hits them and they see more and more what's actually happening, and they do decide that they should be upset about it, that it is messed up, they're too tired at that point.
And it comes back to this like allegory, the story that Stebbins says. I think Stebbins is honestly the wisest character in the book. Mm-hmm. But he talks about how they're all working for the carrot. Mm-hmm. So the carrot is like what you put in front of a mule to get them to keep walking. And as long as they think they can get that carrot, they're going to put in a lot of work for you. But when you take the carrot away, then they're just kind of done.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, all of a sudden when he's just kind of gone, he's no longer motivated by some idea of a reward. He's kind of given up and now he's just walking because he doesn't want to die, not because he wants a reward. And I think that's what the boys are like in the beginning. They're very motivated because they're excited to maybe get this reward, to get riches. They're thinking of all the things that could be, but they're not being very practical about the reality of what's most likely to be. By the time they have essentially gotten older and they've gained wisdom, they no longer have that energy or motivation because they no longer have that carrot. Now they just walk because they don't want to die.
Yeah. And there's so few of them and they physically couldn't at that point.
I think we also tend to accept a lot more as we get older too. And I see that with the boys in this. When you're younger and you don't like something, you're like, well, that rule should change, or I don't like that, or why should I? Or, you know, kids say that their parents like, well, why? Why do I have to do that? When we get older, we tend to accept a lot of things that we don't like, and we're just like, well, that's just the way it is.
Or, I mean, in a less dark way, there are rules that are in place for a reason, and we can, like, process through those thoughts a little more easily.
Well, you could also look at it as, like, when we understand the situation better, we don't have as much hope that it can be changed because mm-hmm. we're like, well, even if we did, what good would it do? They'll just do another walk. Mm-hmm. If we fight back, we're just going to get shot. So what good does it do? And I think a lot of people as they get older too feel a lot more helpless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that.
They start off and they're healthy. And as it goes on, their bodies break down. They're in pain. They make friendships. They watch people that they love die. And ultimately, they die.
And some things just go wrong, like the boy who gets a cold. Things just don't work out.
Olsen says, I did it wrong, but is there a right way to do the walk or to do life? I don't know that there is.
No.
Well, actually, I do. I have thoughts on that. So, a little digression here.
Let's hear it.
So, the very first thing I noticed is a lot of the boys packed food. No. You do not bring any food with you on the long walk. You can only carry so much. They provide you with sustenance. You're going to need to maximize that space you have in your pack as much as possible. Here's what you got to bring. You're going to want some aspirin. You're going to want some Imodium. You're going to want some cold medicine.
A simple DayQuil.
Some bandages. A basic first aid kit should be paramount. Here's what else you're going to need. You're going to want an extra pair of shoes. You're going to drape those puppies over your shoulder. Bring some extra socks, too. You're going to want to train. The only one who actually trained was Scram. I think he did like an 8K or something.
He said several times that he walked for days.
Look at how long walks have been in the past. It's every year. Mm-hmm. Be like, okay, can I walk for 4 or 5 days? Just do it for fun. And when you see how miserable it is, then you can use those back out days because they give you 2 days you can back out. Now that you've like got your head on straight, get the heck out of that.
Exactly.
Or you're just going to outwalk everybody because you actually trained and nobody else did. Here's the other thing. Instead of looking at people eating their delicious jam sandwiches and casting shade, stretch. A lot of boys in this died from Charlie horses.
Cramps.
Stretch, my dude. And stretch your upper body as you're walking.
Yep.
Another thing they say in survival situations is your mental game is really, really important. Anything that's going to lift your spirits. A small music player can make a world of difference. And finally, Donald Duckett.
No pants?
So you should bring pants. On the starting line, no one's going to know you're going to Donald Duckett. Because at the starting line, you got your shoes on, you got your socks on, you got your pants. But then you're like, hey, I'm going to have to drop a number two. This is what you do. Very casually here. Do not get behind. Take off your shoes, tie those together, sling it over your shoulder. Take off your pants. Just carry those around your neck because you do not want to poop on those. And don't put your pants back on until you're done. And here's the other thing you're going to bring. You're going to bring some wet wipes. Here's the other thing. There's freaking people bringing their children here to spectate and watch you potentially get shot.
Right.
Nobody wants that. It's very degrading. It really wears down on the mental wellness of these boys. Mm-hmm. So you should have your dick out. If they put a camera on you, take your dick out.
Yeah.
Family brings a whole bunch of kids there, take your dick out. Someone tries to fight you, here's what you should have done, Rank. Don't be trying to fight Barkovich. Take your dick out. He's not going to try to fight you if your dick's out. He's just going to be like, you're fucking weird. If he doesn't think you're weird, do a helicopter dick. He'll think you're weird and leave you alone.
Yeah.
Problem solved.
Be the weird one.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that, my friends, is Haley's guide to surviving the long walk.
Though, okay, so then we're going to swing this back here, since I've gotten a little off track. We're going to swing this back here to life. One of the last things we do when we die is evacuate our bowels.
Yeah.
A lot of these boys die pooping.
Yeah, a lot of them do.
So I want to talk about the sex stuff. This review I read on Goodreads caught my attention because I have to agree to a certain extent here with some of his criticisms. This guy, Jay, gave The Long Walk 2 stars, and he said, I am once again asking Stephen King to be less horny. The man will find a way to bring sex into anything. I'm not surprised that people found out that he was Richard Bachman. They looked at all those descriptions of boobs and unnecessary sex scenes that didn't fit with anything else going on and were like, classic Stephen King. So like I said, they are very horny. But I also feel it's kind of like if you were told you were going to have to go without water for 2 weeks, you'd be desperate for a drink.
Absolutely.
The fact that they know that they're probably never going to touch a girl again, that this is the rest of their life, I think they're almost desperate to have this experience of maybe losing their virginity or having their first kiss, because they're faced with the fact that it's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
As far as me agreeing with this man, there's a lot about Garrity as a child and his friend Jimmy. So apparently him and Jimmy played doctor. And to quote Stephen King, they both got boners. That is the word he uses, boners. They both got boners. And then their parents found them, called each other. And his Garrity's mom threatened to make him walk down the street naked. I'm assuming with the boner to humiliate him.
Yep.
But it does seem like this idea that he might be attracted to men is something that he's afraid of. And that is a very real fear, or was a very real fear for people in the 60s. I'm of two minds on how this book deals with homosexuality. On the one hand, some of it seems potentially open-minded. So like McVries and Garrity both had relationships with women before the walk. And Garrity's girlfriend even begs him to not go. And she'll even give up her virginity when that's what he's really wanted her to do for a while. And he turns it down. And as they're on this walk, McVries does flirt with Garrity quite a bit. Like he'll blow a kiss with him. And he even offers at one point to give him a hand job. I do think part of that is McVries pushing buttons.
Yeah.
But he does seem to like this boy for really nothing to do with his personality. So I wonder if maybe he does actually have an attraction to him, because Garrity is not a nice boy.
A few things about this book that I thought were a little ahead of its time, like it takes place in May, and May is Confirm Your Sex Month in the book. I don't know exactly what that means, but it wasn't a thing that existed in America in 1967.
Well, and then there's this quote by McVries when they're teasing McVries and Garrity about their relationship. And the quote is, he thinks we're queer for each other, McVries said, amused. He what? Garrity. He's not such a bad guy. Maybe he's even right. Maybe that's why I saved your ass. Maybe I'm queer for you. And these are our heroic characters, so this isn't seen as something that's supposed to be read as a joke or something.
Right.
So I think that is a little ahead of its time. Especially at the time, somebody being bi or pan or having any kind of spectrum of sexuality was not really a conversation.
Yeah.
You were either gay or you weren't gay. And so I think that part of it is ahead of what we were seeing in other books from the time.
Well, and two, maybe, I mean, this is a little less clear and maybe not even part of the thought, but like understanding relationships and what love is, like love as friendship versus love as romantic. Like they're going through something really big and traumatic and there's a lot of emotions. And it's like, do I really love you as like you're the last person I'm going to see in my whole entire life? And I love you as this person who I've gone on this journey with? Or is this a romantic love? And being young enough that they don't really know what the difference is between those things too. Discovering who they are. There's a lot of different layers to it.
Yeah. And I think they're also trying to figure that out for themselves.
Absolutely.
There is another quote in here I wanted to read. The Vanguard was in plain sight, which I had to look up that word. That's the front of the line.
Oh, okay.
Two tall, tan boys with black leather jackets tied around their waists. The word was that they were queer for each other, but Garrity believed that like he believed the moon was green cheese. They didn't look effeminate, and they seemed like nice enough guys. Not that either of those things had much to do with whether or not they were queer, he supposed, and not that it was any of his business if they were. I was like, yes, bravo, because
yes.
That is 100% true.
I think I highlighted that part too.
Yeah, I thought that was well ahead of its time. So I think the last thing I kind of want to talk about in regards to the themes of the novel is mob mentality. And essentially what I mean by that is how in a group, people will behave in a way that they know is wrong, but it's because everybody else is doing it. We have people who are taking their families to an event where they know full well young boys are going to be shot in the head.
Yeah.
There's high school kids there with cheerleaders and such treating this like it's a football game. And it's not. It's a very tragic, horrible thing, but they're treating it like a sports event. Normally, you would know that going to watch somebody get shot in the head is a very bad thing. Murder is supposed to be one of the worst things we can do to each other. But because the tribe essentially is saying that that is acceptable, then it is.
No, I agree with that. I think there was a lot of times where they talked about the crowd being pleased, the crowd being its own entity, and how they hated it at one point. Let me find this quote, actually. The crowd could not know that they were cheering, but somehow they did. Somehow they understood that the circle between death worship and death wish had been completed for another year, and the crowd went completely loopy, convulsing itself in greater and greater paroxysms.
I think what they mean by that is essentially a lot of young girls, especially in the crowd, seem to be really turned on by the idea of the walkers.
Mm-hmm.
It's this idea of sex and death being two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
They know these boys are going to die. And there's something about that, like this idea of flirting with death, that is sexually exciting.
Yeah.
Likewise, the boys know that they are going to die soon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are desperate to have any kind of interaction with the people on the sidelines. One guy, I think his name was Gibbons, he actually dies that way.
He dies of blue balls.
Yeah.
Like, that seems like a lie.
I chalked it up more to he had a cramp and they were calling it blue balls. But even then, I don't know if medically that's very accurate.
Yeah, he died. He stopped. I think this one, because there's this list on Wikipedia of the order and like why people died, and it just says overstimulated. But it was blue balls.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So also just the way the crowd behaves, they behave and they do things like, we know not to touch other people's feces. We know that that's mm-hmm. disgusting. It is a prime animal part of us to avoid feces because it can make us sick. However, these boys are defecating in the street, and they know that crowd members will go and collect some of their poop.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Garrity makes a note of how, like, that's not an uncommon thing where people will take their trash. One point, a boy gets the discarded tube from their food rations, and he's like, thank you!
Yeah. And they sell them. They can make money off of these artifacts. I found the other quote here. It says, crowd was to be pleased. Crowd was to be worshipped and feared. Ultimately, crowd was to be made sacrifice unto.
I think it boils down to how an individual loses their identity in a crowd. You are no longer you. You are crowd.
Mm-hmm.
You lose your identity. But there's a lot of organizations that do that. And I think that's what Stephen King is ultimately getting at. Art has two different organizations he talks about. He's very religious,
mm-hmm.
but it was something passed on to him. It's not something he sought out. He also was a member of the KKK, and he talks about how they put a cross in a black person's yard, and someone was like, well, why would you even do that? And he had no answer for them.
Yeah.
But because the group says that is acceptable, you do it. You don't question it. You lose your identity, and with that, you lose your values. You lose your morals. You just become crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it can kind of tie into the systemic oppression, too, of it. When you're under the government's thumb or somebody else's thumb And there's like propaganda, right? Like nobody in this world can speak out against the walk. You can't speak out against the major. You can't speak out against anything. So the truth gets buried, right? The masses don't know the truth. They just know what they can and can't say. Does that make sense?
It does. And I also think it comes down to the two ways that systems control people, two ways that we see governments especially oppress people, and it's the carrot and it's the stick. Mm-hmm. If we can't get you motivated by some kind of reward, mm-hmm. then we are going to deliver a punishment. Mm-hmm. So the long walk is an example of you're going to do this because you can get this great wish, mm-hmm. but you also better not talk badly about the walk or the squads will come and they will kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how Garrity's dad dies. He speaks out against the government and they take him away in the middle of the night.
And I think we see that with the boys as well, because in the beginning, they are very much a product of the way they were raised. Mm-hmm. When they see the major, and Garrity is even kind of almost disgusted with himself, they all salute, even though he's like, I'm not going to do it. And then he does it. And they don't really want to wave at the crowds. They're kind of scared of the crowd. They're also a little disgusted by the crowds. Mm-hmm. But they do because it's the polite thing to do.
Yeah.
So a lot of their behaviors in the beginning are really dictated by the society that we live in. You know, you need to be respectful of the government. You need to wave because it's what's asked of you, what's expected of you. Mm-hmm. And it isn't until later on that they start to question these systems and they start to rebel and take ownership of their own identity. But even then, I think they've traded one organization for another, mm-hmm. because then there's the organization of the boys, and that becomes the only thing that is important to them. That is why Barkovich ultimately has his big breakdown, mm-hmm. because their new society is the Walkers, and he has not been accepted by any of them.
No, he's been outcast by them.
Exactly. He also has a lot of guilt over what happened to Rank. So if he can get the other boys to agree that what he did was an accident, if the organization decrees that it's an accident, it's an accident. Mm-hmm. If they say it's not, it's like when you're in court mm-hmm. by a jury of your peers.
Yeah.
If they decree that what he did was murder, then he is a murderer. He needs to accept that. And he can't accept that. Mm-mm. He's like a 16-year-old boy. He can't. And so ultimately, he kills himself.
He loses his mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really, really sad.
The other problem here is the boys realize too late that any opportunity they had to rebel and potentially overthrow the soldiers mm-hmm. has long passed. It would have been when they were at the beginning of the walk when they had a lot of energy.
And more numbers.
But it kind of goes back to, like, at the beginning of the walk, their organization that they identified with would be their families and the government. So that's where their loyalties are. That's where they're getting their value systems from. By the time that organization has switched to becoming the boys and that is their new loyalty, they no longer have the physical strength or the numbers to go against the people they perceive as their oppressors. Mm-hmm. I also think this idea of organization and stuff is what makes McFreeze such an interesting character, because everybody seems to have this idea of where they belong. At the start of the book, McFreeze is a character who belongs to nobody. He joined because he has nothing left to lose. And I think that's why he's breaking so many taboos. That's why he's one of the first people to bully somebody else, you know, with Olsen. That's why he's flirting with Garrity. I feel like McFreeze is finding kind of a sort of freedom from the organization, from the groups, from everything he's been taught.
Well, he doesn't have anything else to lose, and this is the only time that they have left to figure it out. Like, this is it. If he doesn't figure it out now, he'll never know what he was made of.
You know, Stebbins has a lot of wisdom, and he tells Garrity to, like, look at Olsen, but I think he should have had him look at McFreeze, because McFreeze, the energy he has throughout the walk, mm-hmm. I think comes from this freedom he has. Mm-hmm. He never wanted the carrot. He never wanted the prize. And knowing that you don't want the prize from the very beginning, it gives you the freedom to not be afraid of the stick.
Freedom and power. He definitely had a level of power, and it was what made him such a magnetic character. I mean, Garrity was our main character, and he's described as like the glue, but I do agree that maybe it was actually McFreeze who showed them all what freedom really was and like gave them the ability to like push through further than they may have been able to go in the first place.
He even dies on his own terms. He just decides to sit down. It was his choice.
Yep.
But yeah, like in the beginning, he doesn't want the prize. So he's free from that. And he's not afraid of you shooting him. Mm-hmm. So he is free in a way that none of the boys are. I mean, I think he's one of the only ones who actually wins.
I agree.
He got what he wanted.
Yeah. Everything was on his terms. So something fun that we decided we want to do is do a top five list every episode, depending on the theme of the book that we read. So for today's episode, we are going to give you a list of our top five dystopian novels. Haley, would you like to start with your top five dystopian novels?
Okay, so I've numbered mine.
Okay.
From least to most importances.
5 to 1.
Number five, Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. All the fun nostalgias of the 80s. Good times. Number four, I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. What I really liked about it so much was we have a character who is terrified of these people who have succumbed to this virus that turns them into vampires. And he's so afraid of the monsters. And he just wants to survive to the point that he is the last man on Earth. And now he is the monster. He is the thing that monsters are afraid of. Then number three, The Stand by Stephen King. It's just such an epic story. And it's like heartwarming, but it's also terrifying. It's just really, really great. I love it. Then number two, Dungeon Crawler Carl by Matt Dinneman. That this world sucks. I'm very claustrophobic and I do not want to be stuck underground in a dungeon. I do not envy these people. But the way the characters persevere and just the amount of humor that's mixed in with all like the heartwarming stuff and then the action, it's fantastic. And then you just have Princess Donut, the talking cat. It's just everything.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that wasn't your number one.
Number one, I'm going to have to give it to The Hunger Games.
Okay.
I think it's got the best combination of very good world building, thematic relevance, and really good characters.
Well, my top five dystopian novels in no particular order. I'll start with the first one that I ever read, which is The Giver by Lois Lowry. I don't remember a ton about this book, if I'm being honest, but I loved it when I was a kid. I just read it over and over and over again. I also picked Ender's Game. That was an early one in my literary life that I loved, and there's a twist, and it's so cool and exciting. The Wool Silo series by Hugh Howey, I also picked. Also a great show on Apple TV if you get the chance to watch it. Also, That Hideous Strength series by C.S. Lewis. I wouldn't have initially thought of it as a dystopian novel, but it was on a list. And I talked to my sister, who's also a English literature major, and she says it's a dystopian novel, so I'll go with it. And that story is essentially a man who gets taken to outer space by these other people, and he goes to Mars, and he goes to Venus, and it's a very religious allegory type story. I am not a religious person, but it's such a cool story and a unique way of looking at the world. It's definitely in my top books of all time, not just dystopian novels. And then I picked The Long Walk by Stephen King. Yes, and we'll talk more about why as we discuss our general thoughts and feelings. As I was reading this novel, the existential dread that came over me was so intense. I spent a whole night just panicking about how I was going to die at any second. Like, you're reading this book. It's about boys walking. How terrifying can it be? Well, very is the answer. Very terrifying. I would say it's one of the most pessimistic books I've ever read in my life. It's so horrifying in like a real life way. I read a review on Goodreads and, you know, this isn't a book about killer clowns or haunted hotels. It's so real. Like, you can imagine walking for a long time. Most people have had their feet hurt at the end of a long day, but then multiply that by 100. Like, it's something that you can imagine going through.
I think overall, what is really remarkable about this book to me, the writing is incredible. Mm-hmm. He hadn't even finished college yet. His one, just understanding of human experiences and characters. The amount of honesty he writes with is always really compelling. It's really impressive that he was this strong of a writer at such a young age. It was one, I had a really hard time putting this down.
Me too. I kept thinking that something was going to change. It wasn't going to end the way that it did, that they were going to maybe find a way to overrun the soldiers and to break the cycle. I felt like it couldn't be as hopeless as it was. Like I when I started the book out, I had hope. And then as it went on, I felt like I was spiraling with the boys. And yeah, it really put me, I don't know how he does it. I don't know how Stephen King does it, but I was there. I was on that walk.
There was a really good review I read on Goodreads. It was by Kay, who gave it 5 stars. And it said, if this book doesn't make you feel physical pain, I don't know what will. Mm-hmm. And to that, I want to add a quote from the book that will just put it into perspective. So this is from chapter 15. His feet had headaches, terrible migraines. He could feel them swelling each time he put his weight on them. His buttocks hurt. His spine was icy fire. But his feet had headaches, and the blood was coagulating in them and swelling in them and turning the veins to al dente spaghetti. Just the imagery there, like you feel it. And I've never known that extreme level of foot pain, but you feel it. He puts you there.
Al dente spaghetti.
Oh,
that's disgusting. I never.
That's a visual. That is a visual.
I can feel it in my mouth.
Yeah, I taste it. I'm tasting it.
I also took that whole review by Kay and I just copied it into my notes. I felt like it really encapsulated what I felt about the book as well. I've never felt so awful and enjoyed myself at the same time. I mean, right now, I don't think I have any real criticisms of the story. I could be convinced otherwise, but
I mean,
I have nothing but praise.
I have criticism.
Let's hear it.
My biggest criticism of the book is I think it would have been a lot more interesting if he had multiple point of view characters. I would have liked to see how different humans responded to the walk. I would have liked to get out of Garrity's head. We're still trapped on the walk, so I don't think it makes it any less horrifying. But to understand some of the other characters and maybe different ways of looking at it would have been interesting. It also, for me, killed a lot of the suspense. I kind of guessed early on that Garrity was going to win.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I do think that the being in just one person's head the whole time really gave that like claustrophobic, this is it kind of feeling, at least for me. But it would have been interesting to see other characters' perspectives.
The other big criticism I have is I wanted an epilogue. The ending feels incredibly abrupt, and I really had a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. The Major, he should, theoretically, based on where he's standing, be able to see his dead son in the road. Some kind of acknowledgement of that. Mm-hmm. Something. I wanted an acknowledgement.
He's not that kind of man.
It doesn't have to be sappy,
right.
Even just telling somebody to pick up the body.
Right.
Anything. I just wanted to know that he saw it. I wanted closure.
Mm-hmm.
How Garrity's mom responded.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know if Kathy ever got the money that they all agreed that they would give Kathy.
Yeah.
What happened with the baby? Did anything change in the world? Did the walk keep going on? Was this a significant walk in any way? Did it stand out for people or was it just another walk?
Mm-hmm.
You could have even shown the beginning of the next walk or the recruitment. An epilogue, I think, would have been great.
Yeah. I would have liked answers to my questions, for sure. I did have a lot that I was like, well, what about this? Oh, but what about that?
The other big criticism I have, and we kind of touched on this earlier, is it really doesn't make any sense to me that people just sign up for this. I think there should be the option to sign up, but they should have drafted it and done it through a lottery. Maybe that he thought that would be too on the nose because he is making, you know, allusions to the Vietnam War.
Right.
But it made zero freaking sense to me. The fact that they all signed up, I don't know. That was really hard for me to believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to know what kind of a world this is that they would have signed up for it.
My only thought is that they live in a world that has nothing. There are no sports games. There is no television. And people want to feel like their lives are important, that their lives meant something. And people tend to feel that way when they get attention, you know, how many likes you got on a video or the amount of attention you get, like if you got a standing ovation at your play. Mm-hmm. And if there is nothing people can participate in, no sports, no war, no nothing, the only thing is the walk, mm-hmm. then the only way to feel like you have any kind of, I guess, fame or adoration or importance is to join the long walk.
Yeah, there's no other legacy.
But if that's the case, I think it should have been a little more clear.
Well, and I mean, you think about like shows like Survivor, right? Like we watch a lot of Survivor and we have our favorites that we root for along the way. And we have people that are the villains that we're so happy when they get voted off or when, you know, something gets twisted around and there's a blind side. Like maybe they watch The Long Walk in the same way and they have people who they root for and they have people who they put their money on, people who they're happy when they go down. But
yeah, like in the Hunger Games, you have the career tributes mm-hmm. who are doing it to make their families proud. Mm-hmm. You have people who were just essentially picked by a lottery and they don't want to be there. I think the way that it's so realistic and it's just treated so like this is just the way it is good. But it could have done with more world building. Mm-hmm. And that would have made it a little more interesting and a little more believable.
And I mean, it was Stephen King's first novel, but we now know that he has no problem giving us 700, 800 page books. I would have read this book if it was 700 pages.
I don't know about 700 pages, but compared to other King books, it is one of the shorter ones. Another 100 pages I would have welcomed.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Give us more.
So with the Strange and Unusual Book Club, we want to have conversations with you as well, anybody who is listening to this. And the ways that you can participate are sharing your reviews on the books we're reading on Goodreads or sharing with us on our social media. For this one, since it's our first podcast episode, I just grabbed a review from one of our fellow book club members, Heather Smith. So Heather gave it 3.75 stars. And she said, I appreciated and respected the reasons why Stephen King wrote the book in response to the Vietnam War. It was an interesting concept and the plot had me intrigued. Such a simple task. Just walk until one person is left. Very dialogue heavy. The deaths were brutal and hard to read about since you truly rooted for every boy in the long walk. Not an enjoyable read due to the content, but it was well written and easy to follow. I'm not the target audience for banter between teenage boys. So the talk about their bodies and what they thought of women's bodies was lost in me. Was it realistic? Yes. I just got tired of reading about it after two scenes. I did enjoy the brotherhood and friendship that was formed between the boys. It made it even more difficult when each one got their ticket. I think this was a decent book, but I think the movie adaptation will translate better for me. I will say, based on her review, she absolutely will like the movie a lot more because that is something we get more of in the movie and the characters are a lot more likable.
Heather, reach out to us. Tell us how you like the movie, too. We referenced Kay's 5-star review on Goodreads as well. And I just want to read this one part of their review because it's a really long review, but it's good. I think it's worthwhile. But this one part just really stood out to me. The story's downward spiral from the optimism of the first 10 hours to the torturous hell that is the last 10 hours is slow, relentless, and ultimately certain. Some of the boys' deaths were incredibly cringeworthy, not because their deaths were bizarre or fantastic, because it was so damn relatable. I can't relate to a woman running away from her ghost-possessed boyfriend as much as I can imagine my legs giving out after hours of walking in my own blood and pus.
Yeah, that's brutal. And I also think, you know, because I, you know, we are mothers. I also saw that a lot of this book I saw from the point of view with what their moms are going through, especially when you have Percy's mom. She shows up twice in the book looking for Percy. I think the second time, I think he's already gone. Yeah. I don't remember. But it was heartbreaking to me, like imagining what their mothers, what their families are going through, having very little say so. You know, again, you could equate that back to war. Like, you know, your son gets drafted or something. There's mm-hmm. nothing you can do. Now, all of a sudden, you know, like when your kids are little, you're the boss. But when they become adults, they answer to other organizations.
Yeah, and you can't stop them from enlisting.
Yeah, I think even more horrifying than imagining this happening to me is imagining it happening to my husband or my son.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. Like, I think about my stepson and if he would maybe sign up for something foolish like this. And it would just be, it would be horrifying to watch.
And their moms, a lot of them did beg them not to go. And they just tried to give them like cookies or just something. But it's really hard and really, really painful. And you think of like Scram, you know, his wife is at home waiting for him. And it's, that was really heartbreaking because he talks about how they had a good life. They were happy. And any happiness in this very dark world they live in should be cherished in the fact that now it's just gone. I think she would much rather just have him there without the money.
Yeah, she would rather have her husband be there and be poor. I mean, I can relate to that a little bit. Like, my husband used to be a wildland firefighter, and it was very, very dangerous. And there was a year where somebody else, not on his crew, but he had worked with before, died. And that was the year that he left because I couldn't take it anymore. There were other reasons why he left, but like, I would rather have my husband home with me. I don't care. Like, yeah, you're a hero. That's great. I'm really proud of you. I'm glad you love your work, but I would rather have my husband be home with me.
And you're so powerless because it's entirely up to him. And whether or not he lives or dies is up to the decisions he makes. There's nothing you can do. And I guess that is the point of view of the reader, isn't it? We're watching these boys and you have boys you care about. I actually liked little Barkovich. You have boys you care about, but you can't just pluck them out of the story and push them to the sidelines. You can't save them. There are so many boys in this, like Art, Scram, where I thought it was so unfair and there was nothing I could do.
So, Haley, what do you rate The Long Walk?
So I gave it a solid 4 stars. I definitely think, particularly considering his age, this is remarkably well written. And there is a lot that can be discussed and dissected about this book, and it certainly was never boring. However, I was left wanting more from this book. And I think when it comes to dystopian novels, there are books out there that have given me that bit more that I want. I also really wanted to like the characters more. I really, really there's a lot in here I didn't need.
Yeah.
That seemed unnecessary, like the backstory and the scar and stuff. I really didn't need that.
Yeah. Okay. I gave it 5 stars. And I'm going to attribute that mostly to the feelings that I had while reading it. Even though I did want more when it was over, I wanted more answers to my questions. That feeling still contributed to my overall dread and despair that I felt with the book. When I was reading about the characters and the whole thing with McVries and the thing that he went through with his girlfriend and how Garrity acted and the things that he thought, like, it all built this just horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach and in the back of my brain. And I gave it a 5 just based on vibes alone.
Would you reread it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I never would.
I think I will reread it, actually, at some point. I'm going to take a break.
This book made me tired.
I'm going to take a good long break, but I will revisit it, I think.
But I absolutely think this is a book that's worth reading. I highly recommend it. I do think you should read the book before you watch the movie. I read the book and did the audiobook together, so there's like big chunks I listened to the audiobook on. If you've listened to the audiobook on this and you haven't read the print version or the Kindle version, I think it is worth doing so. One of the things I thought was really cool about this book is at the start of every chapter, there is a quote from some kind of a game show that I felt kind of helped with like the whole theme of this being like essentially a death game.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the reading of it versus the listening to it helps the building of the tension and keeps the pace. That 4 miles per hour pace that they have to walk the whole way through. I agree with that. I didn't listen to the audiobook at all. I only read it physically. And I think that made a difference.
I enjoyed both. I thought the audiobook narrator was really good. And I listened to it when I was taking a walk, which I just feel like kind of added to it. If you can listen to this book on a treadmill, do so.
Yeah. 4 miles an hour. Don't stop.
That'll add the pressure right there.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, that was really fun. So the next book that we are reading is The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. Between life and death, there is a library. When Nora Seed finds herself in the Midnight Library, she has a chance to make things right. Up until now, her life has been full of misery and regret. She feels she has let everyone down, including herself, but things are about to change. The books in the Midnight Library enable Nora to live as if she had done things differently. With the help of an old friend, she can undo every one of her regrets as she tries to work out her perfect life. But things aren't always what she imagined they'd be, and soon her choices place the library and herself in extreme danger. Before time runs out, she must answer the ultimate question, what is the best way to live?
And before that, we also have a bonus episode. So typically, Strange and Unusual Book Club, you get a new episode every other Tuesday. But this next Tuesday that we're coming upon, you will have The Long Walk, book versus movie. What? What did we think of the movie? What's different? I don't know. You can check it out. So if you want to join the Strange and Unusual Book Club, it's pretty easy. You just follow us on our socials and keep listening to the podcast. You can interact with us on Goodreads, where we have a Goodreads group. You can find us on Blue Sky, Instagram, Facebook. We are also on the platforms YouTube, Spotify, Apple, and SoundCloud.
You can also visit our website, www.subcpodcast.com.
You down with SUBC?
Yeah, you know me. Yeah, so reach out to us. Tell us what you think about our upcoming books that we have listed. Give us your reviews. Give us your recommendations in all the places. And we're working on a Discord server. Stay tuned.
And of course, if you have any recommendations or things that you would like us to read along with you, send those to us as well, because when we pick out books, we definitely draw upon the things that you guys are recommending to us. Midnight Library was recommended by Mummy Bee Movie.
All right. Well, until the next chapter,
stay weird and keep reading. We did it.